Welcome to Striving for Consensus, optimizing the selection and sequencing of therapy for patients with relapse refractory follicular lymphoma. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. For this think tank style program, I am joined by Dr. Carla Casullo from the Wilmot Cancer Institute in Rochester, New York, Dr. Laurie Sen from the BC Cancer Center for Lymphoid Cancer in Vancouver, Canada, and Dr. Matthew Matasar from the Rutgers Cancer Institute of New Jersey in New Brunswick, New Jersey. This is part three of this three-part series. And to begin, Dr. Sen gives a presentation on novel therapies in follicular lymphoma.
We spent a lot of time talking about bispecifics and CAR T-cell therapy, both very exciting options for patients, but really to think about what are some of the other options that are available to patients and what might also be offered to patients along their journey with follicular lymphoma. So EZH2 is a histone methyl transferase that is very important in the biology of lymphoma in general, but particularly follicular lymphoma. We know that it is very important in normal B-cell biology, where it actually regulates germinal center formation, and that patients can acquire EZH2 mutations that can actually block cells from terminal differentiation and lock them into basically a malignant state. So it's not a very common mutation in follicular lymphoma, only happens in about 20% of patients, but we do think it has relevant impact on the pathogenesis of even patients with follicular lymphoma that don't carry mutations. So tazemetostat is a selective oral drug that was a first-in-class EZH2 inhibitor. It was approved based on data that looked at a cohort of patients that included relapsed refractory follicular lymphoma, including patients who had the EZH2 mutation and patients that were termed wild type, so without the mutation. So these were patients that had already been exposed to at least two prior lines of therapy. And in this phase 2 trial that earned it its approval, we saw that the overall response rates were actually higher in patients that had the mutation, so almost 70% versus 35% in wild-type patients, perhaps not surprising based on what we might expect. But looking at the progression-free survival, it was actually quite comparable regardless of whether or not you had a mutation or wild-type. So the median progression-free survival was approximately 14 months in the patients who harbored the EZH2 mutation versus 11 months. So this to me is a drug that has, I think it's fair to say modest activity, but does have some efficacy in follicular lymphoma. And what probably was most compelling that led to its FDA approval is that it's very well tolerated. It's an oral drug. It gets administered to toxicity or progression, but patients tolerate it really, really well with very little in the way of toxicities. Interestingly, it is moving forward and being tested now in combination studies. There's a large randomized phase 3 trial that is testing it in combination with lenalidomide and rituximab against lenalidomide and rituximab alone, and this is now ongoing. We saw the initiation safety analysis from this trial presented, and it appears to be safe and feasible, so it is moving forward to the phase 3 setting.
So, Matt, just kind of curious if you can provide a little granularity about how you see this drug in your own practice currently now with some of the other alternatives we have, and where the assay fits into your decision.
Good question. So as Dr. Sen described, this drug's greatest single asset is its toxicity profile. It is extraordinarily well tolerated by patients. And because of that, it really has a very attractive role for patients who are old, frail, have major comorbidities, patients who may receive Rituxan monotherapy as their first line treatment, because you don't anticipate they'll be able to tolerate multi-agent treatment, and then need second-line therapy. Again, you're reluctant to treat them with chemotherapy or with lenalidomide because of comorbidities. Tazemetostat is really the standard of care for just such a patient. And I've seen it work very well in just those patients, I would add.
I agree. I like tazemetostat for those reasons. I find it to be very well tolerated. People like oral therapy. They don't necessarily mind that it's just given indefinitely because it is so well tolerated. I think that because the response rates aren't that deep, it's okay, in my view, for someone that doesn't have a huge burden of disease. It's not that they need treatment, but it isn't some emergent scenario. And so I have used it in both EZH2 mutation lymphomas with the EZH2 mutation and in those with wild type, given that the disease response, progression-free survival, seems to be quite comparable.
All right. BTK inhibitors and follicular lymphoma.
Yeah. So the next option I'm going to talk about is the recently approved combination of zanubrutinib and obinutuzumab for relapsed refractory follicular lymphoma. And this was based on data that emerged from a randomized phase 2 study called the Rosewood trial. Now, in this trial, it enrolled patients with relapsed refractory follicular lymphoma who had had at least 2 prior lines of therapy again. And it was a 2-to-1 randomization with a combination of zanubrutinib and obinutuzumab versus obinutuzumab alone. You might argue it's not really kind of a fair fight. We don't use a lot of single agent obinutuzumab. In the zanubrutinib and obinutuzumab arm, the zanubrutinib was given indefinitely, so longer therapy in that arm as well. But the primary endpoint was overall response rate. And as I said, it was just a phase 2 comparison. But what we learned from this trial is that many of the patients enrolled in the trial had multiple prior treatments. So median number of prior treatments were 3. So keep in mind, we're talking today about a lot of treatment options, but patients will go through treatment options and need to go on to something else. But they were quite refractory, with many patients having been refractory to rituximab and other prior therapies. On this trial, the winner was the combination of zanubrutinib and obinutuzumab, with the higher overall response rate, which was the primary endpoint, being almost 70%. And about 40% of those actually were complete remissions. When we look at the durability, you see from the progression-free survival curve that the combination led to more durable control, with a median progression-free survival of 28 months compared to only 10 months with single agent obinutuzumab. And this is something that you could argue was quite well tolerated. So many of us use BTK inhibitors for other types of B-cell malignancies. We know that, you know, I think some of us were surprised to see the efficacy from this trial, because there have been numerous trials looking at ibrutinib that had somewhat, you know, lackluster efficacy. Although in this trial, combined with obinutuzumab, the second generation zanubrutinib, which we know is quite well tolerated by patients, actually had really notable efficacy in follicular lymphoma, providing quite durable benefit for some patients. So this now has been FDA approved and is available as a treatment option, but it is going on to be tested in a randomized phase 3 trial called the Mahogany trial. Here it's being evaluated both in patients with marginal zone lymphoma as well as relapsed refractory follicular lymphoma after at least 1 prior line of therapy. The randomization for follicular lymphoma will be the zanubrutinib-obinutuzumab combination that we just discussed versus lenalidomide rituximab. And in marginal zone, it will be the zanubrutinib with rituximab against R-squared.
So, Carla, any thoughts about or experience with zanubrutinib obinutuzumab?
Yes, we have used the combination in follicular lymphoma. As was already discussed, it's very well and tolerated and commonly used in other lymphomas as well. So we have a lot of experience with zanubrutinib. And it's a nice choice for patients that want an oral therapy. And then in combination with obinutuzumab, I think it's a very appealing option for deepening the response rate. I agree that the obinutuzumab monotherapy arm wasn't really fair, given that we don't really use it that much or at all. But I found that the combination seems to be effective.
All right, let's talk about tafasitamab.
Yeah, so I'm going to present data from the InMind trial, which was recently presented in the late-breaking session at the ASH meeting. This was a phase 3 double-blind placebo-controlled trial that actually compared a novel combination of the anti-CD19 monoclonal antibody tafasitamab combined with R-squared versus placebo plus R-squared alone in patients with either follicular lymphoma or marginal zone lymphoma who had received at least one prior line of therapy. What was presented at ASH was the data in follicular lymphoma because it was the primary endpoint of the trial, and that primary endpoint was progression-free survival as determined by investigator. I'll just point out that in the trial design, both arms are getting what we would consider the standard backbone of lenalidomide and rituximab for 12 cycles. And in the experimental arm, patients are getting tafasitamab monoclonal antibody for up to 12 cycles. And the first three cycles, it's given weekly, and then it's given biweekly until cycle 12. So the duration in both arms of treatment is the same. This was a fairly large trial enrolling 550 patients. I'll point out that I think there was quite a high-risk population. So the median number of prior treatments was only one, but 45% of patients had more than one prior treatment. But many patients were high-risk in that about a third of patients were POD24. A high proportion of patients were refractory to their last prior treatment, and also about 42% were refractory to a prior anti-CD20 monoclonal antibody. The primary endpoint was progression-free survival as determined by investigator, and you can see here that there was a significant improvement with the addition of the tafasitamab. So the median went from 13.9 months with R-squared to 22.4 months with a tafasitamab combination. And importantly, this was corroborated or confirmed by an IRC assessment, which was really quite concordant. And you can see here from the hazard ratio of 0.43 that it really represents a 57% reduction in the risk of progression or death. Looking at various subgroups, so all pre-specified subgroups of the protocol were looked at, and you can see that quite consistently across all subgroups, patients seem to benefit from the tafasitamab addition, and particularly the higher risk subgroups that we worry about, those who have POD24, those patients who are refractory to prior CD20 monoclonal antibodies, or patients who have had multiple lines of therapy, all seem to benefit. Just to kind of drive that point home, I think one of the biggest groups that we worry about these days are patients who do have progression within 24 months of their initial therapy, the POD24 group. And you can see whether or not patients were POD24 or not. They both had a significant benefit from the tafasitamab. And then on the lower part of this curve, you can see that whether or not patients had had only one prior line of therapy or more than one prior line of therapy, they benefited quite similarly. Also improved with the tafasitamab was the overall response rate and the PET-CR rate, which was significantly higher with the combination. Similarly, time to next treatment was notably longer. So patients might relapse, but when do they need to go on to their next line of therapy? That was significantly improved with the tafasitamab, where the median was not reached and was just over 2 years with the R-squared arm. At the time of this analysis, which had a median follow-up of just about 15 months, it was quite early, of course, to see any difference in overall survival, but there was a hint of improvement with the tafasitamab. What about toxicities? You know, R-squared is a commonly used platform right now, and here we're adding an extra monoclonal antibody on top of it. So you always have to worry about what that is adding to toxicity. And importantly, the toxicity was not very different between the two arms. So adding the tafasitamab didn't compromise the ability to give lenalidomide. So there was really no real difference in terms of discontinuations or dose delays or need for dose modification. The most common grade 3 or higher adverse event was neutropenia, and it was very similar in both arms at about 39 and 37%. The most common toxicity, I'd say, across the board, both with R-squared and the TAFA R-squared is that, you know, we do worry about infection in these patients, and the common infections seen were pneumonia and COVID-19. And it's fair to say that that risk was slightly higher with the tafasitamab and lenalidomide rituximab arm, which is not surprising as we do know that it's going to add to the immunosuppression. But most of these patients did well, as there was no difference in the death rate related to the tafasitamab. One thing I'd like to point out is that most people are used to using R-squared in their patient population, and that's based on data from the AUGMENT trial. And AUGMENT was a trial that randomized patients to either rituximab alone or to R-squared, and that's the trial that earned R-squared the approval in the relapsed refractory follicular lymphoma. I'll just point out that that trial was actually a relatively good risk population in that patients had to be sensitive to anti-CD20 antibodies, so they couldn't be refractory. And, you know, physicians had to be willing to have their patients randomized to a rituximab arm alone. So we sort of did a comparison of clinical characteristics of patients enrolled in InMind versus patients enrolled in AUGMENT. And you could see that across the numerous parameters that we look for that might determine risk status, which includes FLIPI score, high tumor burden disease, presence of B symptoms, refractoriness to CD20s. I mean, all of those were higher in the InMind trial.
So just curious what all three of you think about this, including Laurie, but I'm going to start with you, Matt. Any comments about these data? Would you like to use this triplet? Do you think it's going to be approved?
I mean, when Laurie herself presented these data at this most recent ASH, I think that they made quite a splash in the community. I can't speak for everybody, but speaking for myself, I was kind of blown away by the incremental benefit provided by tafasitamab. I think it exceeded what would have been my a priori expectations. Combining Carla, that with very little increased toxicity, I think it's a win. And I would be very open to using this when I would be currently planning R-squared.
So, Carla, anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, I think our experience with tafasitamab in large cell lymphoma sort of positions us well to kind of have a complementary population in follicular. I was very excited by this, and I think so many studies are looking at lenalidomide, rituximab, and something else. So I think this is nice to see that it's something that we're accustomed to using, and I think seems really promising. So if it's approved, I think it would be very appealing to have as a choice.
Laurie, any comments? So were you yourself surprised by the data?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, tafasitamab, we know, has already been approved for relapsed refractory diffuse large B-cell in combination with lenalidomide, but there had been really no real investigation in follicular lymphoma. So, you know, this was taken forward very quickly into this randomized phase 3 trial. And I think what's most notable here is it really is the first trial that's combined two monoclonal antibodies together in a regimen for follicular lymphoma. And probably in terms of all lymphomas, as far as I know about. So it really is a unique platform where we're now seeing the, you know, at least additive benefit of combining a second monoclonal antibody, which we're all used to treating patients with monoclonal antibodies.
All right, let's finish out with a few other novel agents.
Yeah, so just maybe a look into the future of what's coming. Also at ASH this year, we saw some interesting data of some agents that are coming through the pipeline. So golcadomide, of course, is a first-in-class CELMoD or immunomodulatory agent that we've all been watching the data slowly emerge. This was a update on a phase 1/2 study of golcadomide, which was done in patients with relapsed refractory follicular lymphoma after two prior lines of therapy. And essentially what they demonstrated is now they've treated more patients. So initially they were using it as a monotherapy, then added it in with rituximab. It's still in the phase where they're testing various doses. But across the board, what we've seen with this oral agent is that it seems to have quite notable efficacy, where you can see the response rates are actually quite high, and many of those patients are actually achieving a complete response. I think what's also notable, I mean, this is an agent which, you know, I think everybody is looking at to be possibly the next generation of lenalidomide. It appears to be actually pretty well tolerated, with just cytopenias being the primary toxicity. So this is an ongoing study. It's still very early data. There's just small numbers of patients, but I think there's reason to be optimistic that it has a fairly high response rate and it seems to be quite tolerable. It's really hard to know right now from this data, you know, how it's going to add up against lenalidomide, which we already have available. So the other study I was going to point out was a phase 2 study looking at nemtabrutinib. So we talked a little bit about the zanubrutinib obinutuzumab combination. I think that's opening the door for other BTK inhibitors to reconsider follicular lymphoma. Here we've got nemtabrutinib, which is a novel non-covalent BTK inhibitor in development, and it was tested as a treatment that was given to toxicity or progression in patients who had had at least 2 prior lines of therapy with follicular lymphoma. Here we see the overall response rate was 40%, so a little bit modest, with most of those responses being partial remissions, very few complete responses. This is very early data, and the study is still ongoing. It's only 29 patients. But I would say that it did show some activity. It showed very good tolerability with, you know, limited toxicities that were seen. But most likely, if it's going to move forward, it's probably going to have to move forward in combination. And then finally, the last drug I'll mention was also a phase 2 study that was reported. This was a single institution study looking at the combination of loncastuximab tesirine, which is an antibody drug conjugate targeting CD19 combined with rituximab in patients with relapsed refractory follicular lymphoma after at least 1 line of therapy. It was an interesting trial design where they adapted the duration of treatment based on the response seen along the way, where patients received up to 39 weeks of treatment. At the time of reporting, I think which was quite notable, is that there was a very high response rate in this trial, being 97%, with the majority of them, almost 80% of patients, achieving a complete response. And the progression-free survival curve there speaks for itself, quite high at the time of analysis, with a median follow-up of 18 months. So this is, I think, early data. As I said, it's single agent, single center, you know, sort of small patient population, but I think enough that it's certainly quite intriguing that I expect this agent is going to go on to further evaluation in follicular lymphoma.
All right, let's hear a little bit about your cases, beginning with the 82-year-old woman.
Okay, so the first case is an 82-year-old woman who does have some comorbidities with hypertension, type 2 diabetes, and osteoarthritis. She originally presented with stage 4A follicular lymphoma, was low bulk and asymptomatic, and this was way back in 2014. And I gave her a course of single agent rituximab, so all done in a month. And that really held her disease for about 5 years till she presented in 2019 with progressive disease requiring treatment. And she received my standard of care, which is still my standard of care in the front line, which is bendamustine and rituximab for 6 cycles. And she achieved a CR. Although I still offer patients maintenance, at the time of COVID, we were stopping maintenance. So she just stopped after her 6 cycles. And this held her for about 6 years until just recently she presented to my clinic and clearly has progressive lymphadenopathy above and below the diaphragm. Her staging investigations now show a bulky mass in the abdomen, but she has no B symptoms. Her LDH is normal and her SUV max was 9. I'm not very suspicious for transformation. We're actually going to obtain a biopsy, which is still in the works, but I'm in the process of planning my next therapy. So I'd, you know, would throw out the question, what treatment would you offer this patient now?
So Carla, what would you be thinking about?
This is a very typical situation. And I think that in an 82-year-old person with some of her comorbidities, I think this is a situation where tazemetostat has a lot of appeal. Certainly, you could consider lenalidomide and rituximab as well. However, I think that I probably would lean towards tazemetostat. It doesn't sound like she would have any contraindications to that or lenalidomide from what I can see here. And so, yeah, that's probably what I would do, recognizing that, you know, if she didn't have the bulk disease, you might consider even single agent rituximab again. You might not see the same duration of response or depth of response, but you certainly can try that too. I think you could go in a few directions here.
Matt?
Yep, this is a case that proves the embarrassment of riches that we have right now with our armamentarium. I would also talk to this patient about mosunetuzumab. This is third line treatment because of her prior Rituxan as her, you know, quasi first line, but this is technically third line, which would put mosun on label. We know that it's very well tolerated, that bulk is not an adverse factor with regards to response, fully outpatient therapy. It would be an additional consideration for discussion.
So, Laurie, of course, you have the advantage of actually knowing the patient and kind of their interests and values, et cetera. What have you been thinking about?
Yeah, so, you know, it's funny that Matt used the word quasi-first-line therapy. You know, I kind of struggle. Is this lady second line because her first line was really for asymptomatic disease and was only a month of rituximab? Is she somebody who fits more in the data that we know about for third line therapy? I think all of the options are on the table for her. I have to say, probably thinking about a bispecific antibody in her, but I think, you know, R squared or even TAF R squared, if I had availability to it, which I don't right now. But I think all of the options are on the table. So I think this is a really good case where we're going to sort of present her the options and see where her preferences lie in terms of convenience. But regardless, you know, I think toxicity concerns would be paramount in this lady with multiple comorbidities. And I can be sure I'm not going to be pushing CAR T cell therapy on her for sure. Okay, going to my next case. This is a 41-year-old gentleman, so relatively young patient with follicular lymphoma who has no comorbidities when he presented. He first came to my attention in 2020 when he showed up with fairly symptomatic disease, but was determined to have stage 3A follicular lymphoma, disease above and below the diaphragm. It was deemed to be grade 3A by histology. He went on to receive our standard frontline therapy of bendamustine and rituximab and achieved a partial remission. He did go on to receive maintenance rituximab, but unfortunately, after 4 cycles of maintenance, he exhibited progressive disease. So in 2022, we actually enrolled him on a clinical trial here that, in fact, it was the tafasitamab lenalidomide rituximab trial, but he got randomized to the placebo with lenalidomide rituximab, which he received for 12 cycles, and he achieved at best a PR, but came off that after 12 months and went on a period of observation. But 8 months later now, he is progressing, but not only progressing, he had quite rapid evolution with symptomatic disease, developing shortness of breath, abdominal discomfort. His imaging showed new peritoneal deposits, new pleural effusions, SUV max in the abdomen was 19. His LDH was slightly elevated, but his biopsy of the most suspicious area still showed follicular lymphoma grade 3A. So I'm contemplating right now what our next move should be.
So let's go to Carla. What would you be thinking about in this situation? And would it be any different if the patient actually got tafa-len-R?
I don't know that it would make that much of a difference if the patient still ended up having a PR. But what you can see from here is that this is high-risk disease in a young person who really never fully achieved a deep remission to anything, no CR at all to anything, and progressive disease with now what seems like the same histology, but very, very resistant disease. So this is a situation where I think CAR T therapy is an appropriate choice. He's young and has no comorbidities. He can probably tolerate the toxicity. And to me, that would, given the longest follow-up that we have with CAR T amongst our choices in the third line, that to me would probably be a good choice, recognizing you could certainly use a bispecific antibody, but I probably would have the conversation of CAR T with him at this point.
Matt, any thoughts? And if you let me just ask, any preference in terms of type of CAR T, Carla? Assume you have the choice.
I think axi-cel makes sense. It's among the highest responses and has the longest follow-up in terms of being able to predict the duration of response, but certainly all of them are appropriate.
Matt, any thoughts?
Yeah, I agree with Carla that this is the type of patient that you'd be very comfortable having conversations around CAR at this juncture. Young, otherwise fit, no comorbidities, with highly refractory disease. The choice of CAR is a little bit challenging. You know, I think if you ask 10 docs, you'll get 10 opinions. I think that given his youth, a preference for either axi-cel or liso-cel over tisa-cel, I agree, would make sense. Splitting hairs between axi-cel and liso-cel for sure. Your question about whether it would make a difference if the patient had received tafasitamab is an interesting one, because while we saw how powerful the addition of it was to R-squared and inMIND, we don't yet know a lot, or at least I don't yet know a lot about what's happening with patients who are progressing afterwards and whether loss of CD19 has been observed in these cases. As we know, CD19 is the target for the currently commercially available CAR T-cell therapies for FL. So at least in this instance, we don't have that concern as we pursue the biopsy.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking about. In this program we did yesterday on CAR T for myeloma, we're starting to see data on prior BCMA therapy before BCMA CAR T, and it looks like maybe there is a difference. What have you been thinking about in terms of this patient, Laurie?
Yeah, so I fully agree with the comments that have been made. I have to say the other thing that was on the table for me was, you know, this gentleman had never seen anthracycline-based therapy. I wasn't sure if he harbors transformation, even though I didn't pick it up on my biopsy. So I was contemplating O-CHOP and even consolidated transplant as another option for him. But in the end, after discussion with him, we decided to side with CAR T-cell therapy. So he's on the road to axi-cel right now.
Incidentally, you mentioned O-CHOP. In what situation do you use O-CHOP versus R-CHOP?
We do know that there was data looking at the combination of obinutuzumab and bendamustine against bendamustine alone in patients who were known to be rituximab refractory, having indolent lymphoma, and that showed an overall survival advantage. So in my own practice, when I have follicular lymphoma patients that are known to be refractory to rituximab, as this patient I just described, when I go on to use a next chemotherapy platform, I've sort of extrapolated that data to add the obinutuzumab rather than the rituximab in. So although that trial included only bendamustine, you know, I think extrapolating it out to other chemotherapy platforms seems reasonable.
Yeah, we use obinutuzumab a lot. I think in the situation of this case, when someone's been exposed multiple times to rituximab, even if they don't meet the criteria of being truly rituximab refractory, which is sort of loosely defined as kind of 6 months. But I think that it's always appealing to use something that's a little different because your patient may get a better benefit from it. So I would completely agree with that.
Matt?
Yep, completely agree. I think we're all very comfortable making that extrapolation. We know that patients who are rituximab refractory are at higher risk for treatment failures, and anything we can do to stack the odds in their favor, like switching our antibody, we're eager to do so.
All right, let's finish out with your 73-year-old lady.
Okay, well, this lady is 73 years old, but does have numerous comorbidities, including rheumatoid arthritis, and has been on methotrexate for quite a long time. She was diagnosed with stage 4A follicular lymphoma, grade 1 to 2, in 2011, treated back then with BR for 6 cycles, and did achieve a complete response, and then went on to complete 2 years of maintenance rituximab. In 2022, though, so 11 years later, she developed progression. And at that point, you know, we had this discussion, you know, what would we treat her with? And to be honest, I didn't have R-squared available in my clinic at that time. So she elected to go on an alternate chemotherapy, and I treated her with RCVP for 6 cycles, and she achieved a really solid PR with that, and didn't need treatment until more recently when she presented this December And on routine surveillance imaging, although she's feeling really great, she now has bulky adenopathy with a mass up to 12 centimeters. But the PET scan tells me the SUV is quite low and in keeping with indolent lymphoma. Her LDH is normal. I already mentioned she's asymptomatic, but we did do a biopsy regardless, which confirms follicular lymphoma grade 1 to 2. So we're in discussion about what to do next.
Matt, any thoughts? And does the presence of rheumatoid arthritis on methotrexate affect in any way how you think through this?
It does for me, absolutely. And I, you know, putting on my hat as a cellular therapist as opposed to just a straight up lymphoma doc, I'm collaborating with rheumatologists at our site and nationally, evaluating CAR T cell therapy as a definitive treatment for autoimmune arthritides, systemic sclerosis, a number of different autoimmune conditions, inflammatory myositis as well. And the data there are very encouraging that CD19 CAR T-cell therapy can be a very powerful and potentially even curative disease-modifying therapy. So here, depending on her fitness and her willingness to receive such therapy, it could be, as we say, a real BOGO, right? A little buy one, get one free to treat her, both her lymphoma and potentially reverse her rheumatoid arthritis in one fell swoop.
Can you explain the idea behind why CAR T would affect or patients would benefit with something like rheumatoid arthritis or any autoimmune condition? Like, what's the pathophysiology or pharmacology?
So particularly for autoimmune conditions that are felt to be B-cell mediated with disease-specific antibodies being the mechanism of injury, a treatment that can be initially B-cell lymphodepleting, that's clear, and we use rituximab for RA all the time. But the rheumatologists believe that there is some sort of immune reset that they're seeing in patients following CAR T-cell therapy where the immune reconstitution afterwards is no longer in that context elaborating disease-specific antibodies.
Carla, any comments about this case or about this interesting idea going beyond cancer for CAR T?
Yeah, I'm not familiar with that literature, but I agree it is very interesting. This strikes me as a patient with what I would consider favorable biology. She had a very long duration, 2011 to 2022. She's really had the standard treatments hasn't really seen a lot of novel agents. This is one of those scenarios where I would be concerned about toxicity. I think having been on methotrexate probably for years subjects her to having a higher risk of infection. So that's a consideration. Depending upon what she is up for, she's technically eligible for any of the treatments that we discussed today, CAR T, bispecific, zanubrutinib, obinutuzumab, R-squared. You know, I think here it's really a matter of leveraging the extent of her disease, her tolerance of toxicity, but you really could go in a number of directions here. If she were my patient, I probably would discuss bispecific antibody with her first, recognizing that you really have a lot of choices.
So, Laurie, what are you thinking?
Yeah, I agree. My first thought, though, was, you know, okay, definitely not CAR T-cell therapy in a patient like this. She's got comorbidities. But I have to say, then I was reminded of the data that's emerging, you know, for various autoimmune disorders with CAR T-cell therapy. And it is an intriguing idea. But I think, you know, weighing in all options right now, to be honest, her arthritis is actually quite well controlled. I don't think I'd be closing the door on future CAR T. And so although I will discuss that option with her, just knowing her, I suspect she's not going to jump for that right now. And more likely, I'll probably be discussing a bispecific antibody with her.
Let's finish out with your thoughts on the interface between community-based general medical oncology and tertiary centers. Let's start with you, Matt.
We know that the vast majority of patients in America with FL are being treated by community oncologists. And the importance of their understanding the rapidly evolving landscape and all of these new tools and the potential to leverage them on an individualized basis, doing some of this shared decision making, for them to understand the breadth of choices available to their patients, mm-hmm. and to encourage conversations with local academic oncologists to try to choose wisely with and for our patients.
Carla, anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, I think that when someone, you know, strikes you as not your typical patient with follicular lymphoma, someone that has either disease that's not behaving in a way that you would expect, either early disease progression or early transformation or disease that really has required multiple lines of therapy, I think that's an important patient to refer sooner than later because we have so many good choices. We could initiate treatments and then give them back to the community oncologist. So I think knowing when to refer is an important concept. And then trying to bear in mind that clinical trials still have a role in these diseases, even though they have a favorable survival. And trying to avoid repeating certain treatments like repeating anthracyclines or repeating bendamustine-based therapy, given that we have such a huge amount of treatment options available.
Laurie, final comment?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I would reiterate that, you know, for many years, we thought that we had follicular lymphoma figured out. You know, there hadn't been a change for a little while. Of course, the addition of rituximab to chemotherapy led to marked improvements in overall survival, progression-free survival. But then we were sort of stuck with relying on chemoimmunotherapy. And really has been over the last only 3 to 5 years that we've seen this flourish of options available that have taken us moving away from chemoimmunotherapy more into the realm of immunotherapy and other targeted therapies, which means that patients do have a wide array of options. And as more data emerges, I think we're going to see competing trial results that, you know, trials that are compellingly positive, but in the same populations. And just, you know, the question is going to be more and more what treatment and in what patient and what time. And that, I think, may take a collaborative approach. So I really do think that community doctors should rely on their academic colleagues to help them sort through the data and certainly stay abreast of all of the data so that, you know, they can have educated conversations with their patients, who I ultimately say the patient gets the last word, you know, and patient preference is really coming to the forefront as well.
This concludes our program, and be on the lookout for the other two parts of this program. Special thanks to the faculty, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Striving for Consensus, Current and Future Management of Relapsed Refractory Follicular Lymphoma.